You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.
So could we talk about evolution?
Anytime.
Okay. You know, I was never personally interested in evolution per se.
Right.
But after my awakening in 1986, I basically was teaching, as I was taught by my teacher, and this was my experience, that everything simply was as it was, and that there was nowhere to go, and that there was nothing to do.
Right.
And the whole point was just to realize that. And that, that was basically the beginning, the middle, and the end of the story. And I was also confused at that point, this was only at the very beginning, as to any teaching that would imply time or future or becoming in any way, shape, or form. I was wondering, you know, well, could this teacher actually be enlightened if they were telling anybody to do anything that implied time or future in any way? And then I started to notice in many of the people that were coming to me, in spite of the fact that they were having very powerful awakening experiences, in most cases they still seemed to be very much unenlightened and still would often become, you know, lost in ego, narcissism, greed, self-obsession, neurosis, etc. Still very much lost in small-minded impulses. And I began to put more and more in my attention on the need for the human to actually transform himself or herself to become a living expression of the purity and emptiness that one discovers in the spiritual experience. And slowly over a period of time, more than just the experience of emptiness and the bliss of non-being, actually being able to embody and to manifest that beauty and that perfection and that wholeness as our humanity started to become more and more important to me. So that was the beginning. And then after a couple of years, something started to emerge in my teaching. And I remember, I think it was the first or second year that I started to teach these retreats in India. And I remember I was teaching when something literally just exploded out of nowhere. It didn't come from any kind of precognition. And there was this passion erupted out of me that said that this miracle, this mystery must become manifest in this world as ourselves.
Right.
In essence. And it was a kind of an unbridled passion that shocked and inspired many people, and it shocked and inspired me too. And that was kind of the beginning, and that was 10 years ago. And more over time, it started to dawn on me that this thing that's coming out of me, this passion, is really, it's a passion for more than just enlightenment in the traditional sense of the end of becoming or getting off the wheel, or enlightenment as defined in the Eastern sense, which would be merely transcendence, you know, coming to the end of becoming and transcending this world absolutely and leaving no trace. More and more the emphasis has become becoming an agent of the evolutionary impulse itself, because in surrendering one's ego to that, one literally feels oneself being filled up with a divine and luminous energy and passion to transform the world and transform the whole universe for a sake that has nothing to do with oneself. And so over time I started to realize that's when I started to call it, you know, evolutionary enlightenment or impersonal evolutionary enlightenment. And then there's been this tremendous emphasis, you know, not only on the realization of emptiness and non-being, but of also the need to become a radically and profoundly transformed human who's going to be able to manifest, you know, literally manifest our higher and ultimately divine potential in the world. This was one of the many reasons that I also split from my teacher, because whenever he would hear me speaking about anything having anything to do except getting off the wheel and non-being, he thought there was this corruption and distortion. So I started to feel at a certain point that there's literally, there's different kinds of enlightenment, there's different kinds of awakening that actually have different results. It was only recently when I came upon Aurobindo and Teilhard that I started to hear my own voice. I started to hear this passion for evolutionary enlightenment, for awakening to the truth of who we are, and then allowing ourselves to experience the evolutionary urgency to make it manifest with all of our being, and really experiencing our own perfect liberation in surrendering to that. So what I wanted to start with was to speak to you about this whole question of what, ultimately, what enlightenment is in this context. And also I think it's an important question because many, many people are interested in the whole question of what enlightenment is. And I think in many ways the traditional definition of enlightenment, and also the way many Buddhist teachers and also Vedanta teachers are teaching it, ultimately, if they were taken as their word, could ultimately inhibit the evolutionary process. You know, and I think it's a kind of an interesting question in terms of what enlightenment actually is and what it's all about.
Yeah, I agree basically with everything you said, and I would obviously have just a few different perspectives on it, but you went through a half dozen very important concepts, and maybe we could start with the one you mentioned last, which was different types of enlightenment. And at first that sounds kind of funny, because enlightenment ostensibly is all-inclusive, timeless, all-embracing, unchanging, eternal, and so on. So it's kind of hard to have two different types of those or more. But in fact, even in the traditions, you find at least two major, very different conceptions of enlightenment. And one was prevalent during the axial period, starting around 1,000, 2,000 years B.C. up until roughly 100 A.D. And that was probably best expressed in the early Buddhist tradition, Theravadan tradition, and is expressed in the concept of nirvana, or nirvikalpa, which was basically immersion in a formless realm where there's no manifestation, no objects arising. It is a state of consciousness utterly free of change, utterly free of time and space and self and turmoil. The classic analogy for those who haven't had that experience is it's something like deep dreamless sleep. You enter a state of formless consciousness, and that state was held to be basically the highest state of realization. And that nirvana was thought to be completely divorced from samsara. And the world of emptiness was completely divorced from the world of form. Emptiness was transcendent and timeless. Form was temporal, suffering, pain, illusory, and so on. And the goal, no question, was to get out of samsara, off the wheel, and into nirvana. Starting particularly with the genius Nagarjuna in the East and Plotinus in the West, there was the real revolution in spirituality occurred at about that time. And that was the breakthrough to what could be called a non-dual enlightenment or non-dual realization. And that's a union of both a profound understanding of nirvana or emptiness or the timeless or the transcendent, but it's a realization wedded or united with the entire world of form, with the world of samsara. So the whole notion of the non-dual traditions was not that you got in a state that was formless, unmanifest cessation, but that formlessness or that emptiness was one with all forms that were arising moment to moment. And that non-dual state, or sahaj, in a sense was also the basis of both the Bodhisattva vow and the whole beginning of the tantric traditions. So the idea was that somehow the world of samsara and the world of nirvana had to go hand in hand, or you didn't really have a full, complete, or if you will, integral being. So on the one hand, it's still true that the Dharmakaya or emptiness or the perfectly formless realm doesn't enter the stream of time. But on the other hand, that's only half the picture. The other half is there is a stream of time. There is development. There is unfolding. There is evolution. There is transformation. And the real key to this discussion, I think, is when you realize that the only way you can really permanently and fully realize emptiness is if you transform, evolve, or develop fully in the world of form. The vehicles that are going to realize emptiness have to be up to the task. And that means they have to be developed, they have to be transformed and aligned with spiritual realization. That means that the transcendent and the immanent worlds have to, in a sense, flavor each other.
In the vehicle.
Exactly.
The vehicle has to become perfected.
And going up and coming down. So on the one hand, sometimes what happens is people get kind of dunked into emptiness. They get a radical realization of this infinite, boundless consciousness that they are. And then, as you say, the realization fades. They're back in the same egoic vehicle. They're the same contracted self. They don't know what's happening, but they don't want to get involved in actual practice or transformative endeavors that would make the vehicle more capable of holding that realization in a fuller, more enduring fashion. So that's unfortunate because then, as you say, they're cutting themselves off from getting involved in the world of time. And what's necessary to do in the world of time in order to become a transparent vehicle of the timeless. And so the best of the non-dual schools, and unfortunately I think you're also right, not a lot of them live up to it, but the best of a non-dual or integral realization is that we have to basically work on both. We have to polish our capacity, in a sense, to fully realize emptiness, moment to moment, but it's the emptiness of all forms arising moment to moment. And so we have to have a radical embrace of the world of samsara as the vehicle and expression of nirvana itself. And people err to one side or the other of that equation. They either immerse themselves in samsara or in the sensorimotor domain, nature is spirit, any right, manifest right. object is taken to be spirit, and so on. Or they get immersed in the formless realm of cessation. And I think what we're all interested in, certainly what you and I are talking about, is a realization that encompasses both emptiness and form. And let me just add,
sure.
evolution occurs in the world of form, not in the world of emptiness. But that means evolution is half of the equation. And so unless you can get involved in ways to carry evolution forward, you're not going to be fully realizing the emptiness that you are.
Okay, so good. That's good. So now we're getting closer. Okay, so in your description of the tantric view, where this distinction between nirvana and samsara disappears, because you see, still, you know, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but in that view or interpretation of enlightenment, at least traditionally, the idea is still to be released.
I understand that.
Okay. Now, what I'm trying to isolate here is what I call the evolutionary impulse or the evolutionary imperative. It's this mysterious, ecstatic compulsion to transform the world.
Mm-hmm.
This compulsion is different than, I believe, what is spoken about in the Bodhisattva vow, because, I mean, at least my understanding of the Bodhisattva vow is that one wants to stick around long enough to liberate all sentient beings from being attached to this world so they can realize liberation. But in the evolutionary impulse I'm speaking about, or this ecstatic evolutionary compulsion, the sense is that liberation is found literally through surrendering to this evolutionary or ecstatic evolutionary imperative.
And not getting out of it.
Or compulsion. Basically, that all of one's consciousness and energy and body and blood is to be used in the service of creation. Beyond ego, in other words, one vehicle is to be completely used for this divine purpose. And one's enlightenment or one's ongoing daily ecstatic liberation would be found and directly consciously experienced through utter and perfect surrender to that and that alone. So, I mean, at least in the ideal case, if such a thing is possible, in the ideal case, there would be literally no egoic motive left, and one would literally be here burning up for a cause and a purpose that one understood only partially, shall we say, because its ultimate goal was always in the future.
I agree with the general thrust of what you're saying. Let me reframe it in this way. When I said basically that there was a major shift between the early axial religions that emphasized mere ascent, mere transcendence, and mere cessation, and that the switch to the non-dual traditions was epical because it was no longer emptiness divorced from form,
right.
but a realization that emptiness is not other than form, form is not other than emptiness, as the Heart Sutra put it. Now, that switch to the Mahayana and eventually Vajrayana Buddhism was important because it was different from the two previous main types of religions that we saw. And the earliest was that the world of samsara is spirit. That's basically the immersion in mere manifestation or mere nature. And then came the axial period, which said, no, the transcendent is the only spiritual reality.
Right.
So the merely ascending, merely emptiness, merely timeless is the only thing that's
right.
real.
Right.
And the non-dual said, wait a minute, you're both right.
Right.
And what we have to do is work out a way to do that. So the original Bodhisattva vow wasn't that I promise to put off my own enlightenment until others are saved, because as Kala Rinpoche used to point out, if you put off your enlightenment, how can you save anybody?
That's right.
The original Bodhisattva vow was I vow to gain enlightenment as quickly as possible for the benefit of all others. Now that matured into the tantric view, and what both of them had in common, at least implicitly, is the notion that nirvana and samsara, emptiness and form, the timeless and the world of time, being and becoming, are both parts of an integral realization, and both of those arms have to be embraced. Now, I think you're right that in a certain sense the traditions have not always lived up to that, and I think there's also another meaning of a deepening understanding of non-dual realization as involving an evolutionary impulse in the world of evolving form.
That's what I'm talking about.
And I think the reason that that's the case is just what we're saying, namely that a sage, let's say 1,000 years ago, could have a profound realization of Dharmakaya, or pure emptiness, a profound realization of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, and then also have a profound realization of a union with all form. So this sage would have both a realization of emptiness and the world of form, and would realize they are intrinsically each other. They arise moment to moment as the emptiness of all forms that are arising ecstatically. Now, nonetheless, that almost perfectly enlightened sage, in the sahaj sense, or the non-dual sense, can still only be one with the world of form that is present at his or her time. And that means that that world of form is not going to have the types of knowledge that we now have about the world of form.
I mean about evolution.
Yeah, about evolution in particular.
Right.
The exact nature of it, what it actually means, what is going on in the world of form. And in the world of form, we see an unmistakable drift towards increasing levels of differentiation and integration and complexity and unification.
Right.
And that's a profound understanding, because it means our vehicle in the world of form is becoming more transparent to the processes that are in the world
of
form.
Right.
That changes everything.
Everything.
Now, doesn't matter how geniusly enlightened somebody was 1,000 years ago, the world of form did not include that. And so that wasn't part, if you will, of their realization, even though their realization of emptiness is exactly as great as ours can be today, because the emptiness is emptiness, it doesn't change, it has no moving parts, and so on. So we're not taking anything away from a sage that lived 1,000 years ago. We have one thing on that sage, however, we're alive now.
That's right.
And 1,000 years from now, people will look back at our world of form and laugh hysterically over what idiots would learn.
Right.
But in the meantime, we have to get on with embodying this world of form with radical emptiness, and the result is just a type of evolutionary emptiness or evolutionary enlightenment. Sure.
So, like I, you know, and as I teach, and I also would agree that one is not going to be able to, shall we say, perfectly serve this world or perfectly participate in it if one's not first free from it.
Yes.
Just like Kala Rinpoche was saying.
Yeah.
Unless we're first free from the world, we're not going to be able to perfectly participate in it or perfectly serve it.
Yeah.
I think the significant element in what I'm saying about this evolutionary enlightenment, as I understand it anyway, is the awakened compulsion to participate wholeheartedly in the evolutionary process for a sake that's greater than oneself and for oneself, rather than merely the attainment of one's own liberation or transcendence of or from the world. And it's that shift in emphasis that I'm really pointing to as what's significant, I think, in terms of what ultimately I think is how to define enlightenment for our time. Because, I mean, as more and more people do become interested in what enlightenment is and what it means, you know, 90% of the time, at least, if not more, it's really only about transcendence. And then maybe some ideas of doing some kind of compassionate service, but not the kind of enlightened and liberated, it's a totally kind of tepid, strange mix of old concepts, ancient concepts of enlightenment, and some kind of, you know, green meme ideas of helping the world, where the fire of liberation is not really where it's coming from.
We still have a very strange mixture of these three basic spiritual orientations that are available. One is pagan immersion in samsara. One is idealistic transcendental escape into the world of unmanifest cessation.
Right.
And one is some form of non-dual, which embraces them both. And the form of non-dual realization in today's world is of necessity evolutionary. Non-duality. And people sometimes get put off by the notion of evolution because they think a couple of things. One, they think, well, all this stages crap, you know, I don't believe that, that's ranking, that's marginalizing, we don't like that. Or if they're on the spiritual side, they think what your teacher thought, which is any discussion of the world of time shows that you haven't really grasped being
right.
Or grasped the timeless.
Right.
And so, in a strange way, your own non-dual realization is taken to be a lesser realization than one of these fractured states.
Oh, definitely.
Which is really bizarre. But in any event, it's understandable that people get a little bit put off by the notion of stages or evolutionary unfolding or things having to get higher
higher. Because God forbid that, you know, maybe they have farther to go, and God forbid maybe there's something to do here.
Well, of course, I would never say something
nasty like that.
Yeah,
I know that.
Exactly. But yes, that certainly is one of the reasons that people are put off by it. But when we really get to a fine-tuned discussion of what the difference between states of consciousness and stages of consciousness, I think we can get a better handle on some of these issues. One of the reasons that people do have trouble with stages or evolutionary unfolding is that they have themselves had very profound states of consciousness that sometimes are of a very non-dual nature.
Sure.
And so they are distrustful of the notion that you have to somehow evolutionarily cluck through stages in order to have access to the non-dual. That's not what we're saying. The non-dual or pure emptiness itself is
ever
the
present.
ever-present state of every single stage.
Right.
It's completely present in atoms, carrots, dogs, infants, adults, you name it. And in the human being, even very young infants and children can have a temporary altered state of a subtle, causal, or non-dual nature, for the simple reason that all human beings wake, dream, have deep sleep, that is to say they have gross, subtle, and causal states available to them 24 hours a day, and there is the non-dual, ever-present ground, which is also present to them 24 hours a day. So anybody at any stage of development can have an altered state of gross, subtle, causal, or non-dual realities, but in order for those temporary states to become permanent traits, you have to evolve through the stages of purifying the vehicle in the realm of form in order that it can ecstatically, permanently, continuously embrace these higher states. So,
well, that's where people have the problem.
That's where they have the problem.
Because as you eloquently pointed out in Boomeritis, the ego, or the narcissistic ego, wants to be left alone, violently wants to be left alone, violently resists the idea of not already being perfect and of having to change even more and even more and even more. And you agree that with the perfection of the vehicle, there would be a gradual emergence of a, shall we say, a profound sense of obligation or the ecstatic compulsion to give all of oneself to the evolutionary process so that this perfect purity of our own absolute nature will emerge in, you know, I suppose, in all the four quadrants.
Absolutely. The basic rule is resting as emptiness, embrace the entire world of form.
Right.
And the world of form is unfolding. It is evolving. It is developing. And therefore, resting as blissful emptiness, you ecstatically embrace and push against the world of form as a duty.
Right, push against it.
Yeah.
But that's the important part.
Absolutely.
Because often when people talk about enlightenment, that notion right there, which I completely agree with you, the pushing against the world of form or the inertia of the world in order to enlighten it is really very much what I'm speaking about, and I think a lot of people have a lot of trouble with.
Well, again, I can understand some of the hesitancies and problems with it. But I think just a much more kind of considered look at the various types of evidence available and the various types of states we have available to us, and particularly looking at the past 30 years when so many experiments have been made by this generation in terms of various paths, various practices, and what the actual results are. And I think we're getting to a point now where we realize that really integral practice, a practice that emphasizes both the emanence of spirit in terms of present manifestation. It emphasizes the transcendental nature of spirit. There is a timeless, radical emptiness that is formless, boundless, ever-present, and in some sense, their mysterious union of the non-dual.
Mm.
And it is a mystery. It's a love affair. It's a love affair between Shiva and Shakti. And like all love affairs, we'll never figure it out. Your heart is plunged in the mystery of this. And the mystery is you are radically the only thing that exists in the entire universe, and yet all these forms are arising within you.
Yes.
And in a sense, the denser forms are just your slow left foot.
Right.
But
right.
You have to push against your own density in the manifest world in order to penetrate it with the awareness that you eternally are. And it's that pushing against part that if people can't really engage that, then I'm afraid they really do get caught in states of sort of mere quietude or mere cessation or mere immersion in sensory manifestation.
But Ken, don't you think that's ultimately why we're here, is to liberate ourselves enough from ego and narcissism and any kind of relative perspective or identity in order to do that as perfectly as we're able to?
I agree entirely. And, as you know, the only expression that we individually have is through this particular individual vehicle that we have.
That's right.
Which is why you want to polish that sucker up.
No, but even then, once one realizes this, then there's the ecstatic discovery that being exactly who one already is, not only as the timeless, unborn self, but also, who one is as an incarnated, individuated personality with whatever historical and cultural background one has, suddenly is recognized as being perfect to serve that very function.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an ecstatic release from all the neurotic self-concern in that, because suddenly being exactly who one is becomes the perfect vehicle for that function.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the reasons sometimes some spiritual teachers seem perhaps not to understand what it means, in a sense, to push against the world, is that that pushing comes on the other side of the great release. There is already that radical freedom with the realization of emptiness that is pervading all form. You're not pushing against the world out of a sense of lack. You're pushing against the world out of a sense of duty.
Exactly, and ecstasy and love.
Absolutely.
And compulsion.
Absolutely. So they think, when somebody says what you're saying, they think that person is coming out of a state of lack, that they haven't quite realized the radical...
Or maybe they're not accepting things enough as the way they are. Maybe they have some kind of personal agenda.
Or maybe they have not yet pushed through radically to incarnational non-duality.
Great. Wow, this is great.
It's fun.
Okay.
Well, when it comes down to, and you know this as well as anybody, and in terms of actual practice, it's not kind of a one-step, two-step affair. It's not that, well, I just polish the vehicle, and then I see emptiness, and then I unite emptiness in the vehicle, and that kind of mechanical stuff.
Of course.
The evolutionary, transformational, developmental component, we're sort of going up and going down.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are just immersed very, very quickly in a radical realization of ever-present emptiness. And then they come back and their vehicles are kind of a mess and they have to slowly transform so they can live up to that realization.
Yeah, sure.
Other people have a hard time getting the realization. They have to work or develop for sometimes several years.
Mm.
Whether you develop on the way up or on the way down, so to speak.
As long as one does.
Exactly. And you end up doing it, really, it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very messy, sloppy affair. Sometimes you're dunked into pagan immersion in samsara. Sometimes you're whisked into transcendental, Theravadan non-existence. And then other times you miraculously, mysteriously find yourselves in love with emptiness and form.
Mm. The ecstatic emergence is a messy and often painful business.
Yeah, very much so.
That's what even material evolution is like.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
organic evolution. It's all very messy, and so is spiritual evolution, even though it's ultimately an ecstatic event.
Exactly, exactly.
I remember I wrote to you a couple of months ago about some event that has emerged in my teaching, which was when a group of committed practitioners would come together in the impersonal, and as a result, they would be personally and simultaneously collectively experience the spontaneous descent and emergence of a cosmic presence and power that was instantly enlightening. In other words, instantly enlightening in the sense that there was this immediately sense that this is everything, that there's nothing more. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, in this emergent consciousness, there was this inherent compulsion, or the recognition of a compulsion, that the witness to this descent and emergence must surrender himself or herself to the service of the divine, or a much, or service of evolution itself. And this thing has happened a few times, and I realized every time this happened, this was really very much what my teaching was all pointing to. And until I read Aurobindo's speaking about the supermind,
mm-hmm.
I I hadn't heard of anything else that sounded similar.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he spoke about this, the supermind descending and what it brought, it sounded very similar, if not identical,
mm-hmm.
in many ways to what some of my students were experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if it sounded similar to you or...
I wasn't present for the phenomena you were discussing, but
sure.
I think I get a pretty good sense about it. It does really tie into what we were saying earlier, which is that, in a sense, the non-dual realization, which at least became a historical realization for a fair number of people right around the turn of the century, that was an extraordinary realization that in many ways is still unfolding, or you could even think of it as sort of, you know, non-dual one, non-dual two, non-dual three. I mean, the world of form keeps unfolding, keeps evolving. With spirit's own self-expression keeps unfolding, and it happens, as far as we can tell, to build on what it did yesterday, which is why evolution is indeed an unfolding event in the world of form.
Right.
As this incarnational non-duality and this ultimately ecstatic tantric non-duality itself began to unfold, and its forms of manifestation began to unfold, you find by the time you get to people like Aurobindo, that there's such a full-bodied understanding of this process that even though some of the earlier sages were just ultimately enlightened for that time, that there's a richness, an unfolding, a resonance of spirit's own incarnational understanding in some of these recent sages, which is very, you know, it gives you goosebumps.
So you're talking about, you know, the evolution of enlightenment itself.
Yes, if we talk about enlightenment as the union of emptiness and form, the pure emptiness doesn't change because it doesn't enter the stream of time, but the form does change, and the two of those are inextricably united. And therefore, there is, in that sense, an evolution of enlightenment. And what we find in some of the depths of these sages, particularly in the modern era when evolution itself was understood, which is to say when evolution became part of the consciousness of spirit's manifestation, that we're seeing an increasing transparency of enlightenment manifesting in the world of form. And under those circumstances, the type of descent that Aurobindo is talking about, descent of the supermind, is something he certainly thought would be increasing in frequency as evolution continued. And I think that's certainly the case. The phenomena you describe certainly sounds like it would be a kind of a miniature example of just that. Now, there are a lot of specific things, as you know, that Aurobindo had with the descent of the supermind in a full-fledged way, including very specific bodily transfigurations and so on. But the notion of, in a sense, higher states coming down and grabbing people where they are and lifting them up itself is an old notion. And I think there are many examples of lesser states, in a sense, descending on people. You can be the egoic state and have a descent of a subtle realm, reality, for example.
Sure.
But I think what we're seeing increasingly is that because the world has already been opened to non-dual incarnational realization, that we are going to see these things increasing in depth and profundity as time unfolds.
Well, wasn't for Aurobindo the supermind still a theoretical ideal? Because, I mean, as far as I know, he didn't succeed.
No, that's correct. And that's why I say it's hard to know exactly what was going on with your group without everybody kind of having a look-see.
Sure, of course.
But
I think the important thing was that there was a very powerful meeting beyond the personal.
So yeah.
There was the awareness that I am going beyond the personal together with many others. In other words, there'd be this simultaneous realization of the one and the many at the same time, and actually there not being any difference in realizing that this is everything. At the same time, there's an overwhelming individual compulsion to give all of oneself to the greatest possibility that there is.
I can tell you what I think that is, and quite apart from whether it's the specific instance of Aurobindo Superman.
Sure.
In my personal opinion, what was happening there was a perfect example of basically a all-quadrant, non-dual occasion.
Wow.
And what that means, as you know, is the quadrants are basically I, we, and it.
Yes.
And the general idea, in my own view, is that these are inextricably interconnected,
right,
whether we realize it or not. So sometimes people can just give emphasis to the I, but there's always the we and the it in the background, whether they're aware of it or not.
Yes.
And my basic belief is that an integral spirituality would be all quadrant, all levels. And all levels means, of course, that we're basically spanning the entire spectrum We're not stopping at immersion in nature.
Yes.
We're not stopping at ascent into heaven or mere nirvana, but we're embracing the non-dual as well, so that we span the entire spectrum of consciousness.
Right.
And then on the other hand, that is manifest simultaneously, fully and transparently in all four quadrants, or in the I, the we, and the it simultaneously.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that you have a sangha, a small community in a sense, that could work on this together for a long time, has allowed, in that instance, a four-quadrant manifestation of that non-dual realization. So that would be the good news. The bad news is all these things is, of course, it's a messy process.
Every time
something great like that happens, there's all the shadow stuff that comes with it and the recoil that comes with it and
absolutely.
The aftermath effects.
Absolutely. But
yeah.
Then there's that, and then there's also the egoic withdrawal and, you know, rebellion and fear from the overwhelming, from the sacred nature of what was revealed to it, and profound terror of what was revealed and what it demanded. Absolutely.
That's always difficult. It's always difficult. It's where discriminating wisdom is so important.
Yeah.
And the incredibly difficult thing is that, in some sense, we're all kind of pioneers in this. It's a relatively new type of occasion that is given to the modern and the postmodern form of incarnational non-duality. And therefore, discriminating wisdom is harder to come by, because there are so few precedents, in a sense.
Yeah, I know, because also, it's all new.
It's all new, and therefore, you can't exactly draw on old compass points.
Exactly.
So, a part of these non-dual states always carry a certain type of unshakable certainty. I mean, that's just the nature you're introduced to what is,
sure.
And what is, period.
Sure.
So it's really hard to tease apart the aspects of this that are certain, and the aspects of this where I'm just being lazy, misinformed, egoic, fearful,
absolutely.
Idiotic, you know, those kinds of things.
Isn't that always true, though?
Isn't very hard.
When one's on the edge?
It is. The little difference is that if you're in a tradition where the pioneers sort of figured this out and then handed on the tradition, which is good, like in Zen Buddhism, for example, you've got tradition and lineage to fall back on. They've pretty much looked at all the pitfalls for that particular realization. And in that sense, I think traditions and lineages are very good things. But every time new types of realization come into being, and that means whenever the world of form has so evolved and changed that you need a different type of evolutionary enlightenment or incarnational non-duality, every time that happens, you've got to rewrite the instruction manual.
Exactly. And
we all fuck that up!
And the thing is, that's also where the traditions also can, on one hand, they can establish a standard, but at the same time, in terms of evolution itself, they can at the same time, and often, at least in relationship to what we're speaking about, prevent evolution from occurring.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an old story.
Yeah.
And whatever form we come up with today, we will prevent the new emergence later. We'll do the same mistake ourselves. But
right.
That doesn't stop us from being critical in that sense. And
absolutely.
I'll give you a very specific example, of course, in the field that I work in a lot, and that is our efforts to bring some of the discoveries of Western psychology and integrate them with some of the traditions that have a really sterling understanding of emptiness and non-duality within their own world of form. And it's the same thing. It's that the Vajrayana, for example, is a wonderfully complete system for feudal Tibet.
Exactly.
And it's not to say that the levels they describe aren't here. They are still here. Their realization of emptiness, probably unsurpassed, but the world of form has changed.
Precisely.
And you either get on that train or you become that which prevents evolution. And that's one of the real difficulties. So many of the problems.
Get on which train?
Spirit's evolutionary train.
Okay, that's what I thought you meant.
They basically, as you say, at that point, the tradition which helps stabilize an important understanding becomes that which prevents a new unfolding. And that's very dicey, of course, because then you have to be really careful what you're doing here. But so many of the problems faced by contemplative orders in this country, and I mean Buddhist, and I mean Christian, and I mean Vedanta, could be helped enormously by a simple infusion in the world of form of the understandings from developmental psychology. But they don't want to do it because it seems to imply their tradition is not complete, their tradition isn't a whole path, there's something wrong with the tradition, and so on. And we're really not saying there's anything wrong with the realization. We're just saying that we can help with the vehicle, with the world of form, by telling you things that we have discovered in the world of form that weren't known 1,000 years ago.
Right.
And if you're not going to incorporate that into your own understanding, then your own non-dual realization will be inadequate because you're not living up to the world of form.
Right. I mean, just one more thing on it, because it seems that now, you know, so much is changing so fast.
Yeah.
You know, in the world that I think a lot of the traditions are, you know, in terms of this question we're having, they're going to have a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because the world of form that we're living in is changing so quickly and so radically. And, you know, in the world, because its communication is becoming so much smaller, that in many ways I wonder if the traditions are going to be able to keep up with the needs of spiritually hungry people without holding them back in many ways.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.